Penguin Random House Audio presents Letters by Oliver Sacks. Edited by Kate Edgar. Read for you by James Langton. With an editor's note and preface read by Kate Edgar.
Preface by Kate Edgar. Oliver Sacks adored letters. In London, where he grew up in the 1930s and 1940s, letters and postcards were the way people kept in touch. Relatively few households yet had access to a telephone, but there were 2 mail deliveries a day, so one could, if need be, reply by return post the same day. By the time he was 6 years old, Oliver was away at boarding school, and I cannot help imagining that a letter from home must have been especially prized. Even as an adult, he loved collecting the post each day to see what it would bring him. He always felt that one must reply to a letter instantly, if possible. This seemed to be a combination of good manners and his irrepressible urge to communicate. He was even known to compose a few lines to send to the electric company along with his monthly check. He saved envelopes, especially those from important people or from exotic locations, and interesting postage stamps. We, his office staff, would later do the same, putting them aside for a particular patient or two who collected them. Throughout his life, Oliver kept most of his incoming correspondence and took pains to preserve his own replies, with carbon sets, rough or retyped drafts, or later photocopies. This, of course, was not always possible in the early 1960s, when this book begins. Many of the letters in the first chapters are reproduced from the lightweight, folding airmail missives he sent home to London after arriving in North America. It would have been difficult to copy these at the time, apart from photographing them, but fortunately, his parents saved the letters, and they were later returned to Oliver. His sheer output of letters was prodigious. The correspondence files in his archive include something like 200,000 pages, some 70 banker's boxes full. Oliver's literary style, while vivid and lyrical, was rarely concise, and it was complex in both structure and content. In person, he often spoke in paragraphs with long asides, but finally circling back to the topic at hand. When he was working on an essay or a book, it was much the same. He had difficulty, however, editing his own work. Thus, when one editor or another asked him to clarify something or boil it down, he would simply crank a new piece of paper into his typewriter and start over. Voila, a new draft. Eventually, the editor would have a pile of drafts, to say nothing of a sheaf of follow-up letters with new footnotes and addenda. It was difficult to choose the best among these, since most versions contained wonderful passages, but each headed in a different direction. When I began working with him as a young editor, circa 1983, it seemed clear to me that the only solution was to cut and paste among the many drafts. In those pre-computer days, we did this the old-fashioned way, with scissors and tape, stitching together his various trains of thought. And so, informed by his wonderful stories and his philosophical ruminations, or often simply repeating things he had just said to me, I tried to do so. In time, we worked out a dialogic process of editing. This was new for me. I was used to getting a more or less complete manuscript from an author, reading it through a couple of times, and then making and revising my comments before returning them for the author's consideration. Oliver, on the other hand, wanted me actually sitting by his side as he tore each finished page out of the typewriter. Here, what do you think? I began referring to this as combat editing. I would arrive home after a day with Oliver, exhausted from the nonstop effort of trying to keep up with his restless intellect for 8 hours. but it was also exhilarating work, and when he phoned me an hour or two later with new thoughts, I was ready to dive back in. What started for me as a freelance job, occupying a day or two a week, soon became a full-time vocation, and then some. In those days, Oliver told me a great deal about his youth and early days as a doctor and a writer. He had published two books already, both based on the patients he was seeing as a neurologist. Migraine, 1970, and Awakenings, 1973, already showed his patient-centered approach to his work, his curiosity, and his deep erudition. But though Awakenings had been a literary success, he had received little or no recognition from his medical peers. Quite the opposite. Partly, perhaps because of this, he was struggling to finish A Leg to Stand On, a book he had worked on for almost a decade. He could hardly have imagined at this point that he would one day become a hero to aspiring young doctors around the world, or ignite an entire genre of what he called clinical tales. The letters in this volume are full of contradictions. They are ferocious, tender, observant. They betray a fair degree of self-absorption, the kind many of us might evince in adolescence, but more usually show a concern and generosity, especially for people at the margins of society. Young people, old people, incarcerated people, and of course, patients living with unusual syndromes or maladies. These letters are revelatory even for me, despite my decades with Oliver. They speak of books conceived but never written, of books written but then lost or destroyed, of passionate love affairs, and of his wrestling as a young man with the career choices ahead of him. At one point, in a letter to his parents, July 6, 1961, the man who would one day become the personification of a compassionate physician writes, "I am discovering in a far more intense degree than ever before an extreme aversion to patients, sickness, hospitals, and particularly doctors. The truth is, you know, I should never have become a doctor." By 1970, in a letter to his parents of May 6th, he is hitting his stride, and he writes, "I think that I am a good, and very rarely, at magic moments, a great teacher. Not because I communicate facts, but because I somehow convey a sort of passion for the patient and the subject, and a feeling of the texture of patients, the way their symptoms dovetail into their total being, and how this, in turn, dovetails into their total environment. In short, a sort of wonder and delight at the way everything fits. And it does all fit so beautifully, like a wonderful jigsaw puzzle." One can see that from the beginning he had high aspirations for himself as a writer, perhaps even before he found his true calling as a physician. One can hear his thoughts evolving over a span of decades, returning to the same topics again and again, searching for a new understanding that would fully mature only with the development of modern neuroscience in the 1980s. Sometimes he uses letters to try out new ideas or modes of expression. At times, his letters seem more akin to journal entries or attempts at semi-fictionalized narrative. They occasionally become exercises in the analysis of his own psyche, especially as he begins his journey into psychoanalysis in the mid-1960s. One can feel the evolution of his prose as it becomes more assured, more focused, partly in response to his vast correspondence with thousands of people, from Nobel laureates to schoolchildren. By the middle of the 1980s, after the publication of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, his correspondence broadened to include legions of fans, and many of these people offered him their own stories. Oliver loved writing back and forth with them, and their letters became an extension of his medical practice. Much as Darwin corresponded with ornithologists and pigeons.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?